Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
It's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. Today, we're joined by author and environmentalist John Waterman to talk about a life shaped by wild places, how bearing witness to environmental change and being a moderately reckless beginner can lead to a lifelong relationship with the outdoors. We explore the value of preserving wilderness, and John shares stories of solitude, curiosity, and of course, adventure. He shares what he learned from Indigenous communities and how their knowledge, tools, and resilience have shaped his understanding of the land and how we live on it. His experiences offer a unique perspective on what it means to truly know a place and what's at stake if we lose it. If you've ever felt that a place has transformed you, you'll want to keep listening for more on Outdoor Explorer. John Waterman is an award-winning writer, photographer, environmentalist, and outdoor adventurer. He's the author of 17 nonfiction books and has written for numerous publications, including The New York Times, Outside, Backpacker, and National Geographic Adventure. He has also contributed to several adventure films. He comes to us today from Carbondale, Colorado. Welcome to Outdoor Explorer, John.
Pleasure to be here with you. Thank you.
So you've got quite an impressive list of adventures on your resume. Can you share just a little bit about what sparked your passion for the outdoors and kind of how that informed your path in life?
I think that the single biggest influence was my interest in going to the Outward Bound school as a teenager. And I attended Outward Bound at 16 years old. And that I knew that that was the direction I wanted to take, but once taken, there was no turning back, and I was decided to make a life in the outdoors as an adventurer. And somewhere along the way, shortly thereafter, I became a writer. I initially wanted to be a photographer, and I've worked on that ever since. And finally, I'm doing both now.
Did you come from like an outdoorsy family? How did you end up at the Outward Bound school?
Oh, no, not at all. My family was a tennis family.
Okay.
And I was the outcast. My parents couldn't understand me. So it's just entirely something, some aberrant gene that made me interested in nature and the outdoors. And I read a lot when I was young and have all my life, and was drawn to the works of Henry David Thoreau, and used to swim at Walden Pond. And so the hook was set very early for me. And I was lucky enough to fall in with the right crowd, and initially through Boy Scouts, or Explorer Scouts rather, a branch of the Boy Scouts, and had many other opportunities that came my way.
You wrote your first book, Surviving Denali, while you were working as a mountaineering ranger in Denali National Park. How did you end up in Denali, first of all? How did that happen?
Well, with my explorer post, that branch of the Boy Scouts, when I was a teenager, we tried to climb Denali.
Wow.
In 1976.
Okay.
When everyone... with the exception of a few Alaskans, we're still calling it McKinley. Mm-hmm. And that was a great learning experience. And I decided that climbing was what I wanted to dedicate myself to. So I repeatedly came back to the mountain and guided it, and was offered a job with the Park Service as a mountaineering ranger, which was the most amazing job of my life. I still dream about it. I mean, it's been more than 40 years since I did that. I did go back as a volunteer recently on a mountain patrol again, just half a dozen years ago. But anyways, that book you referred to, Surviving Denali, came right from that job, because I quickly realized in the rescue work that I was doing, you know, hauling people off the mountain and educating climbers that needed educating, that there were a lot of needless deaths and accidents that could have been prevented if people just did a little bit of homework. So there are patterns behind the accidents. People would get frostbite if they had improper footwear and if they didn't hydrate properly, for instance. So I broke the book into chapters of frostbite, avalanches, crevasse falls, high altitude sickness, identifying the patterns behind those accidents. And my boss at the Park Service gave me a research assistant, and I found a publisher, and I spent the off season when I wasn't at the in Talkeetna writing the book, researching and writing the book, and it came out the next year. And it was in print for 40 years and reissued. It's probably in some ways the best book that I've ever done, because I very precisely identified my readership. And I'm certain the book has saved lives.
I actually read a couple of the reviews on Amazon. Well, first I was curious if you could still find a copy of it, but I read a few of the reviews on Amazon, and almost everyone said, you know, this is a great book if you're preparing to do any sort of, you know, major mountaineering expedition. This book will save your life. It will prepare you. And I think that's wonderful that you were able to identify those patterns and really help save people's lives and get them prepared for that.
Yeah, the subtitle could have been "How Not to Die on Denali."
Maybe that might not have been as marketable 40 years ago. Today, I think that would really fly. But have you noticed patterns? I mean, you spend a lot of time outside. You spend a lot of time doing things in the backcountry, and have you noticed similar patterns? I think a lot more of your non-mountaineering things tend to be a little bit more. You know, you're doing more solo things, if I'm understanding correctly, but do you see those patterns elsewhere in your outdoor recreation of people making mistakes and sort of being careless in ways that could be prevented?
Not really. It happened that in that position as a ranger, that I was uniquely qualified to help out.
Yeah.
And I suppose that if I was in another similar role, that I might try to identify the patterns. But the trips that I do now are generally, if not by myself, they're with friends, and I tend to go to places where there aren't a lot of people around.
Yeah.
So there's much time to identify what other people are doing wrong.
Yeah. You've written two other books about Denali, I think, correct? Chasing Denali and there's
Chasing Denali in the Shadow of Denali. And then I wrote a history and a guidebook.
Okay.
Denali, Forker, and Hunter called High Alaska.
Okay. I actually read most of Chasing Denali. I ran out of time on my library loan, but I really enjoyed that book. It dives into the 1910 ascent of Denali's North Summit, and you sort of write about that alongside your climb up the mountain for your 60th birthday. What drew you to write about those two events alongside each other?
Well, it's one of the great mysteries of the mountain.
Yeah.
In other words, did these gold miners in 1910 actually make it to the North Summit in, you know, their claimed 18 hours, which is not even done nowadays.
Right.
And they didn't have any mountaineering experience. And I wish if I were younger, I would simply go up there and I'd dig and look for traces of this flagpole that they supposedly left behind. And that I wish that someone would take on that task. If there was one of your listeners has got a good back and a shovel and some companions that like to shovel, I suggest they go up there and get to the bottom of this mystery. But I tried to piece it together through all kinds of archives and documents and just, you know, theoretically tried to piece together whether they made it or not.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to issue a spoiler and tell you what I think.
Yeah.
You'll have to read the book.
Yeah.
Because you've done.
I have, yes. How did your 60th birthday sort of coincide with that? The 1910 ascent, like how did you decide to sort of talk about those two things together?
Well, it just happened that I was restless that summer and I volunteered to go on a ranger patrol. When I, in the 1980s, when I worked as a ranger, I would find volunteers to come with me on a patrol up the mountain. And so, 40 years later, I became one of those volunteers. And so, on that particular climb, I, you know, spent a lot of time on the summit day staring across at the north summit, the lower summit, wondering if they had in fact done it, and wishing that I had the time or the energy or the youthfulness to go over and dig and look for their flagpole. But it was a wonderful trip. It was actually 40 years to the same summer that I had first been on the mountain. So it was a great experience for me. And the day that I went to the top, I was not trying to make a big deal about it, but it just so happened to be my birthday.
Yeah.
And the other volunteer rangers I was with let the cat out of the bag and had told a few other people, and we passed a couple of groups on the way to the summit, and every time we'd pass a group that wasn't moving, they sang happy birthday to me. And then when I got to the summit, one of the volunteer rangers, a very experienced climber, actually, who had been in Nepal recently, pulled out a kata, which is a ceremonial Nepalese scarf, and put that around my neck when we reached the summit. And I did not stand on the very top, which is something that I've made a point of doing the last few times I've been up there. I've always wanted to not make the climb about conquest. So it was a great last visit to the mountain. Hopefully my last. Hopefully one of my teenage sons isn't going to make me go back up there with him.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. I'm talking to author John Waterman about his many adventures and the books he's written about them.
Oh, I think I can't remember if it's in that book that you talk about how you sort of mentioned you never wanted to make it about conquest, and how you are always conscientious about safety, obviously. And that was one of the reasons that that drew you back there time after time, was making sure that you did everything right and didn't make decisions based on the sole goal of getting to the top. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I can't say that I was the safest climber. In fact, before I got offered the ranger job, I climbed the mountain in winter with two companions, and it was a really dangerous, difficult, and risky thing that we did, because we were way out on a limb, and if the weather had changed when we were on this very challenging route called the Kasin Ridge, we would still be there today, frozen into the side of the mountain, because when the weather changes in the wintertime and you're up high, you can't stand up. As it was, I was sick, and it was a very difficult and harrowing experience for me. And that's one of the reasons I was able to write this book, Surviving Denali, How Not to Die on the Mountain, because I'd done foolish things myself, and I'd gotten away with it, and with just a little bit of frostbite and some altitude sickness. When I was there, when I went back the last time in 2016, a guy came into the ranger tent at 14,000 feet, and he had very badly frostbitten toes. And I walked into the the medical tent, and I asked if I could look at his toes because I was just curious to see how the extent of the frostbite. And I introduced myself. I just said, "Hi, I'm John Waterman, and I'd like to take a look at your toes." And he got all excited. And he said, "Oh, I've read your book, John Waterman." And I said, "Which book?" He said, "Surviving Denali." And I said, and the reason he had frostbitten his toes was because he was wearing single boots, mm-hmm. which is an ultimate no-no on this sub-zero Denali. So obviously, he must have skipped the frostbite chapter.
What a way to meet the person who wrote the book about not dying on Denali, huh?
Yeah.
So, shifting gears a little bit, your Atlas of Wild America was published in, I think it was late 2023, which was just 1 year shy of the 60th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, which is incredibly important to, you know, the wild lands of America, of the United States. Can you talk a little bit about the inspiration for that book and why these wild spaces are so important?
Well, first off, I'm glad that someone has read that book, so thank you. to me, wilderness has always been, you know, an essential part of our American democracy, arguably as essential as are the national parks.
Yeah.
Which I've also written about at depth. But no one's really, people aren't buying that book. No one's really interested in wilderness like they are in national parks. But I did the book knowing full well that I could release it just at the time of the 60th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. And it was my opportunity to extol the virtues of wild places throughout the continent, not only in the U.S. of A., but in Canada and Mexico as well, and to celebrate the pioneers of the wilderness concept, from Aldo Leopold to Bob Marshall, etc. So for me, it was one of the best books that I've ever done. But it's an important book, I think. And at some point, these wilderness areas will, hopefully the American public will recognize them for what they are. And it's an amazing thing because the Wilderness Act created 54 different wilderness areas throughout the U.S. of A. There's nothing like it in the world. And so it's a great lesson to the rest of the world. It's on a par with the whole national park concept. But because these wilderness areas, don't have a lot of infrastructure or interpretation like the national parks do, they tend to be less celebrated and sort of obscure, which I suppose is good. Even if you write a big book about them for the National Geographic, it's still not enticing a lot of people to go. But those lands are protected for generations to come and closed to all mining and development. It's a wonderful concept, in some ways more wonderful than the national parks.
I'd like to think that even if people aren't visiting them, they're hopefully reading about them and understanding their importance. Maybe there's a kid somewhere who's getting that book in the library, and it's inspiring him or her to, you know, go off and do great things, you know, travel the world, see these wild spaces. But even if people aren't actually going to visit them at the same rate that they are going to visit national parks, which, as you say, is probably a good thing, I feel like it's still really an important book to educate people about the importance of these spaces.
Thank you.
Yeah. Tapping into your experience as a park ranger or working in a park, as well as your passion for conservation and your passion for these wild spaces, this is kind of a big question, but how do you think we can balance public engagement with nature while also ensuring the protection of important ecosystems and biodiversity?
You know, that is the operative question right now with our public lands, many of them on the chopping block. It's also the operative question in particular for the national parks, because many of them have become incredibly popular. You know, the tiny national park Zion in Utah is now the second most popular park. There are nearly 5 million people went there last summer, and the crowds are unbelievable. The traffic jams and having to sign up in advance to stand in line to walk up Angel's Landing, one of the more popular trails, is just crazy. And what's crazy about it is that it's at odds with the statute called the Organic Act, which is which created these lands for public enjoyment, but also to conserve them forever. And when you bring that many people, 5 million people, into those sensitive desert areas or wilderness areas like Zion, it is a real compromise on protecting the place. And then when you start firing park rangers willy-nilly, as happened this February, we're at a real crux right now, protecting these sacred lands. America's best idea, as they are also known, the national parks.
Obviously, the goal, right, is to have people visit these places, especially national parks, but there's a point of diminishing returns. But how do we as individuals, what can we do to get people excited about wild places, national parks, but also protect these spaces?
Well, there are several answers to that question. You know, one of them is sort of more pragmatic, and that is the principles of leave no trace, basically going into these places and leaving only footprints, and in some places trying to avoid leaving footprints and taking only pictures, for instance, and taking everything out with you and leaving it as you found it. The good thing about national parks is that they have this built-in infrastructure, i.e. roadways, that concentrates the people into one area. And most of, more than 90% of the traffic stays, for instance, in the center of Yosemite Valley, or stays on the Wonder Park Road to Denali, rather than going out into the backcountry. So by virtue of the inaccessibility of these public lands, they're protected. But then we have other problems, how to protect them. And to get back to your question, you know, if you open up a copper mine, for instance, upstream of Voyageurs National Park, you can quite easily, destroy the water systems where the water flows into the national park. So it's not only protecting these places pragmatically through being careful of our presence, but it's through, proper legislation and a government that is aligned to safeguard these places, which our government is not right now, unfortunately.
One of the things that drew me to your writing initially and then prompted me to want to have you on this show is your experience in the Arctic. And I think I mentioned in my initial email to you that even though I am a lifelong Alaskan, I only recently discovered the magic of the Arctic after a trip up the Dalton Highway last year. And that's a pretty superficial experience in terms of becoming acquainted with the Arctic, but it really deeply impacted me in a way that I can't put into words. And I think that anybody who's been in that area probably understands. And if you haven't been there, it's hard to explain to somebody. Your time in the Arctic has spanned decades. What drew you there initially and what kept you going back there?
Well, I was sent there on a poor me Sport Service exchange patrol from Denali National Park to Gates of the Arctic National Park.
Yeah.
And the trip really blew my mind. I mean, yeah. I was just so taken away by the caribou migration and the amount of wildlife. And like you saw on the Dalton Highway, the same general area that I was in alongside Gates of the Arctic National Park, there's just a vastness that is so attractive and hypnotic for me. And I think for a lot of people, I mean, a lot of people would be overwhelmed by it, but it's kind of humility inducing, if you will, to be under such a vast sky with no trees and trails or no buildings or people and tens of thousands of mosquitoes. But you can fall in love with this place quite easily. And that's what happened to me.
Here's an excerpt from John Waterman's most recent book, Into the Thaw. My disclaimer, 39 years ago, I decided to learn all I could about life above the Arctic Circle. As a climber, I traded my worship of high mountains for the high Arctic. I substituted bears and mosquitoes for crevasses and avalanches. But more importantly, like the study of crevasse extrication and avalanche avoidance, you couldn't just read about the Arctic or sign up for classroom courses. You have to go on immersive journeys and figure out how the interlocked parts of the natural world fit together, without guides or someone to hold your hand. Best to hit the ragged edge of exhaustion and make mistakes so that you learn what's important, and to go alone at least once. Along this path, acts of curiosity out on the land and the water can open an earned universe of wonders. But you must spend time in the villages too, with the kind-hearted people of the North to make sure you get it right. And you can't call the Arctic the far north. It is home rather than far to the many people who live there. So after 20 of Arctic journeys in the summer of 2022, I'm on one more trip. I could not be on such an ambitious trip without all the previous experiences, which I'll use to sculpt a cohesive, whole, and fully developed sense of place. Disclaimer 2, the more I learn, it sometimes feels like the less I know about the Arctic. But this time, the agenda is different. I hope to better understand the climate crisis.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. I'm talking to author John Waterman about his many adventures and the books he's written about them.
You tend to prefer fully immersive trip type experiences, and one of those experiences was a 2,000-mile trip across the Arctic. What was it like to go on a trip of that length, mostly by yourself, almost entirely by yourself, and what inspired you to do that?
Well, I wanted to, you know, since I was a teenager, you know, weaned on the writings of a famous mountaineer named Reinhold Messner, I had in my head that I wanted to do a great solo mountain climb. And I you know, after my experiences on Denali and other mountains, I realized that a difficult solo climb might well just kill me. So I substituted a solo trip across the Arctic because I felt like my odds were better. And I also became more interested in the environment than most alpinists tend to be. I became interested in wildlife and the species and the biosystems and the ecosystems and the damages and consequences of climate change. So by being in the Arctic, I could pay attention to those things. And basically substituted avalanches and crevasses for bears and mosquitoes. But to get more directly to your question, I went because there were several reasons. I wanted to test myself. I wanted to see encounter polar bears. And I've always had a great attraction to remote landscapes. I can look at a map, and by looking carefully at a map, I can imagine what that landscape might look like. And it's to me, it's like pornography. I really want to go and find out what it's like to be there in the flesh. And every time I turn a corner or a peninsula, paddling in my kayak, or walking or skiing on the sea ice, I would get so excited just to see this new vista open up and see what's there. If there was wildlife or the remains of an old expedition are the remains of, you know, ancient nomadic Inuits, you know, pieces of old dog sleds. So it was just the, you know, the general curiosity of an explorer, I guess, that sent me there. But also that there's this kind of a, I've heard referred to as the Arctic Grail, you know, that it was an enticement to cross the legendary Northwest Passage, which that trip mostly allowed me to cross that passage, to go from the Pacific tides to the Atlantic tides. So there were a lot of reasons. I said, test myself. I wanted to see what it was like to be alone for extended periods of time. And there were periods of time, 25 days at one period, I was completely alone. I didn't see an airplane, didn't see a boat, didn't have a sat phone. And it was very scary. It frightened the hell out of me when I started on that particular 400-mile leg from the village of Pawlatuck to Coppermine or Kugluktuk. But once I got in gear, once I was, you know, a week or 10 days away, I was really in the zone. I mean, I had my game together. I mean, I made some mistakes. Once I nearly lost my kayak when I was camped on a tiny island and had to swim after it. But for the most part, when you're on top of your game, when you're really practicing mastery, there's a great sense of satisfaction. And within that mastery, when you're in the zone, you can really focus in on other things like the wildlife and the landforms and the world itself. I became kind of lost. I was lost in it in a beautiful way.
That sounds like a terrifying and amazing experience. And did you relied on like the communities in that area for your like refueling food? How did you plan that out?
Well, I mailed freeze-dried food a couple of times to different villages. Mostly I just went to their co-ops.
Yeah.
That's what they're called in Canada, food co-ops, and just bought food there. Sometimes I got dried fish, which was the best food, the most caloric and rich in fats and proteins food that I could eat. But I didn't run into as many Inuit as I thought I would, because in this day and age, they're not out on the land like they used to be. They're not, of course, they're not nomadic anymore. They're very community oriented. So typically I'd only see them in hunting camps nearby their villages. But those were remarkable experiences for me, because I, particularly when I was alone crossing the Arctic, because I was in their mythical tool. I was in the kayak that they invented. And there aren't many people to come paddling into villages alone in a kayak.
Yeah.
And so they are gracious, noble people, generous to a T. But the fact that I traveled that way opened up doors for me and allowed me to spend time with them in their hunting camps. They took care of me. I shared my stories and they shared theirs. And it's a real insight into their world that I'm grateful for.
I think when talking about conservation and climate change, I think that obviously the Arctic is like one of the most critical pieces of that conversation. I recently read a book called Braiding Sweetgrass. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
It's next on my list.
It's absolutely wonderful. The author is an Indigenous woman. And one of the things that she said that has stuck with me is, what happens to one of us happens to all of us. We can starve together or feast together. All flourishing is mutual. And I think for most of the United States, the Arctic is a place that feels very far removed, and most people don't pay it much attention. But how does what happens to both the land and the people of the Arctic impact all of us?
Well, from a more global physical perspective, the weakening of the pressure systems in the Arctic have allowed much more frequent polar vortexes to sweep down into the lower 48. You know, there are these extreme winters now in Georgia because of the weakening of these air masses in the Arctic. So what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic anymore because of this radical climate change. It's warming nearly four times faster than the rest of the Earth. Or then the diminishment of the sea ice is actually changing the North Atlantic current. And this had been predicted more than a decade ago, this change in the currents as the ice melted back. And it's now begun, and this will eventually cause Western Europe to become a much colder place and simultaneously warming up South America. But then, you know, from a cultural perspective, in the US of A or in Canada, the Inuit, formerly known as the Eskimos, some of them still proudly refer to themselves as Eskimos because of their heritage. They've given us so much, you know, they've invented these tools and this way of living in this frozen wintry landscape. And, you know, as a winter mountaineer and a climber, they invented things that I repeatedly used, like the igloo and the kayak. And I didn't use harpoons, but they invented an amazing device called the toggle harpoon. Not that that's anything that we need anymore, but snow goggles and snowshoes and crampons, they were masters of their particular universe. And we've appropriated many of those amazing innovations into our own world, at least, you know, people who love winter have in the lower 48 and in Alaska. So they are our culture. They are our people, too. Just because they live in the far-off, remote north doesn't mean that we shouldn't be looking after them. And specifically, looking after them means that we have to help them relocate because many of their villages are imperiled by the lack of sea ice and flooding from the lack of sea ice protecting their villages, or the now many rivers are flooding out villages, and the thawing permafrost is wreaking havoc on buildings and roadways in their villages. So we need to appropriate and help their adaptation to this new radically changing environment they live in. I refer to it as a climate crisis rather than climate change. And that's why I wrote my most recent book.
Yeah. So your most recent book, Into the Thaw, it looks at the changes to the people and the culture as well as the environment of the Arctic over the last 40 years. As we mentioned earlier, you've been going to that area for several decades. Can you talk a little bit about the trip that's detailed in that book and kind of what went into the research and what went into writing that book?
What inspired me to write that book was a trip that I did in 2021 with my son. And it was into the gates of the Arctic National Park, where I first went in 1983. And it was such a radically changed place that I wanted to go back and more carefully document what those changes were. So I returned the following summer, 2.5 years ago, and went down the length of the Noatak River to the sea, and then walked a section of the coastline, interviewed scientists while we were in Fairbanks, and then met up with a scientist on the river. And of course, the Inupiat people, the gracious Inupiat, who put us up and fed us in Kivalina and Noatak Village. So the book is mostly framed around that trip that I did in 2022. But I also revisited the past trips I had done in the narrative, like this 2,000-mile journey across the top of the continent. And I revisited those trips and wrote about things that I didn't touch upon in previous writings, specifically because I saw the glimmers of climate change as early as 1997. And I wanted to thoroughly document these changes over the past decades up till 2022.
Here's an excerpt from John Waterman's most recent book, Into the Thaw. Our hoped-for documentation of the climate crisis isn't likely to be easy on this remote wilderness trip. We don't expect a picnic, known as Type 1 fun, to modern-day adventurers. A journey across the thaw on foot and by pack raft for 500-plus miles won't resemble a backcountry ski trip or a long weekend backpack on lower 48 trails. We have planned for Type 2 fun, an ambitious expedition that will make us suffer and give us the potential to extend ourselves just enough that there will be hours or even days that won't seem like fun until much later when we're back home. Then our short-circuited memories will allow us to plan the next trip as if nothing went wrong on this one, as if it were all just great fun with a capital F. Ultimately, an important part of wilderness mastery is to avoid Type 3 fun, a wreckage of accidents, injuries, near starvation, or rescue. We've both been on Type 3 fun trips that we'd rather forget. I have more than a few outdoor expert friends who claim that the real trick of expeditions is always to be in control, regardless of calculated risk activity, and to avoid the proverbial adventure. But I've never really succeeded. No matter how hard I try on my trips in the north, things sometimes simply go south. Someone forgets the stove, you fall and dislocate a shoulder, you forget to tighten the pee bottle in a crowded tent in a storm, you miscalculate a crevasse jump, you shower yourself with bear spray, or someone, not me, lets the tent blow away. You try to avoid these rookie moves, but sooner or later, particularly on a long expedition, the odds are that you or one of your partners will screw up, or the weather will thrash you and you'll have an adventure. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer, and I'm your host, Martha Rosenstein. I'm talking to author John Waterman about his many adventures and the books he's written about them.
I can't remember where I read this, but you are an avid journaler, which is how you have documentation of all of these trips to look back on. How does that process fit into your writing of books? Do you just journal every day? Do you journal when you're on trips? How does your record keeping go into, because obviously that played an incredibly important role in this book, because you have all of that to look back on and have documentation of that. How does that process work for you?
Yeah, well, fortunately, you're right. I did have, journals, for instance, from, all the way back to 1983. I don't journal every day. Actually, nowadays, I actually sporadically do dream journaling. But having those journal entries allowed me to actually focus in on things that I'd seen or experienced. For instance, I met an Inuit elder in the Yukon who described how their bluebirds and robins were coming to his village now, and they'd never seen them before. Or the snow had melted by the 4th of July, and they couldn't do their dog sled races anymore. And that was one of the first, at least cultural, recantations of a changing environment. But also, I've always taken photographs. I took photographs before I became a writer. And I'm not terribly gifted as a photographer. I just, through diligence and tenacity, I've always taken pictures. And I've saved all those pictures. And it's amazing, the old cliche, a picture's worth a thousand words. It's really true how I can pull up a slide from 1983 and put it under the loop and study it. And it brings back a flood of memories to the what I was feeling that day, what the temperature was, what we might have seen that day. So I used my photographs in many instances to invoke and recreate early experiences, whatever was missing in the journals. You can never get it all in a journal. And the problem it's not a problem, it's a challenge that I do these, as you said, immersive journeys, and it means that I'm quite knackered by the end of the day, particularly the last trip, because I was with an amazing guy 30 years younger than me, and the end of the day, I'd be utterly exhausted. So it was all I could do to write in my journal. I'd force myself to do it, keeping up to this young stud. But fortunately, I took pictures during the day too, so I had the combination of the two. That's it in a nutshell.
You also, I feel like your books do a great job of, you know, combining research and Into the Thaw has a lot of science in it, quite honestly. You, in one interview when I was preparing for this, I watched, you mentioned that you didn't go to college because you just didn't really like school and learning that way. How have you been able to, you know, gain all of this knowledge? Not that you need a college degree to gain knowledge, but how do you go about researching and doing all of these things without, you know, an extensive history of formal education?
Well, that's a good question. You know, my parents were pretty well educated. My dad was a renowned mathematical physicist, and he was appalled that I wasn't going to go to school. The truth of the matter was I could barely get through high school, because I just wasn't interested in sitting in a classroom.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of an autodidact. In other words, I learn by myself, by reading or by experiential things. And so I determined that when I was very young, when I was a teenager, that I was going to see the world and learn about it at my own speed, my own way. But I also had the good fortune to be with a lot of people who were, I have close friends who are doctors and scientists, well-educated people. So I was exposed to many friends and mentors who were disciplined writers or journalists or documentarians of things. And I basically followed their lead. And if I have any gift, I'm curious. I'm just curious about the world. And if you're curious, it doesn't matter how you get your education. Is if you just continue indulging your curiosity, the world will unfold before you.
I think that's wonderful. That's a wonderful approach to life in general. One topic related to the outdoors that I actually really love talking about and have touched on in many previous interviews is how to be a beginner, because I think a lot of times people who are new to outdoor recreation or who are interested in exploring a new way of getting outside are intimidated or discouraged by people who have been doing these things for a very long time, mostly because of the way that we talk about those things and we're like, oh yeah, we went on this cool thing and did this amazing thing and it sounds easy and people get intimidated by that. Do you have any advice for people who are looking to branch out into exploring more remote or wild places, but might be intimidated by the idea?
Well, I think that you have to realize that it's okay to screw up, but you just have to figure out how to screw up without killing yourself or killing or hurting someone else. And it's through those mistakes, being a beginner, how to be a beginner. I mean, those mistakes are the best learning experiences that you can have. So I think that it's okay to be moderately reckless at times, if you're curious too, in order to allow the world to come into focus. I don't know if that's very good advice, but that's what I did. And somehow I survived. But I was really paying attention along the way, too.
I have written down moderately reckless to remember that for later, because I think that's a great way to describe it, to be moderately reckless and learn from your mistakes.
Yeah, but I, you know, there's this bumper sticker now. I think it's safety third.
Oh, you know, is it look good, have fun, safety third?
Yeah, and I really object to that because that's not moderately reckless.
Right.
That's totally reckless.
Exactly.
And I mean, that's okay, you know, if you're an indoor partier or something like that. But
right.
it's not okay if you're going on expeditions.
Agreed.
You can only be moderately reckless. You can't have safety third.
I read somewhere, now I can't recall exactly where, that you have another book coming out next year called The Atlas of Historic America. Is that correct?
Oh my God. You have to bring that up.
Sorry. Can you tell us a little bit about that book and what's it about and why did you feel it was important to write?
Well, I got contracted for the National Geographic with a 3-book contract.
And okay.
The National Park Atlas wasn't my idea, but I relished doing it. And the Atlas of Wild America was my idea, and I also relished doing it. But it was not my idea to write an Atlas of American history. But it happens that, I don't know if you can see in the background here, if your listeners could see, if we had video, there are huge bookshelves behind me. And I live in alone in this moderately sized house in the woods with over 500 books. And many of these books are history books because I've always been very interested in history. So I couldn't say no to the idea of writing an atlas of history. And in the end, I collaborated with an academic historian. And the book is due out in fall of 2026. And that is the year that we will be celebrating American history because it's 250 years since the nation's founding. So it was a deep dive for me, but I'm looking forward to it.
Is there anything else that you have coming up or anything else you'd like our listeners to know about your work? Anything we didn't cover?
Well, you did mention that there's a lot of science in my latest book, Into the Thaw.
Yeah.
And that's true. But lest your listeners think, oh, my God, I don't want to suffer through that. I put almost all of the science into side notes, like footnotes, so that it didn't bog down the narrative. And the narrative is more experiential about my travels.
Yeah.
And then whenever I got off into science tangents, I'd put them in footnotes so that it wouldn't be a yawn to get through the book. But I, as you mentioned, I have done more than a few books, and I appreciate you bringing them up.
Yeah, I did actually really appreciate the way that the science, I mean, I'm a science person. I did appreciate the way that that was integrated. And I think you even, I haven't looked at that book in a couple of weeks, but I think you even actually like provide like scientific paper references for a lot of the things that you've talked about in there, which I think is a great combination with the experiential things, because that provides people to, you know, you can go read some more about it yourself if that's something that you're interested in. But also if you're not interested in it, you can glaze right on by it. So I did really appreciate the way you integrated both of those things together.
Well, thank you. I was very deliberate about that for people that could look up these things if they wanted to learn more. But
yeah.
The other part of my deliberation was that I know that there are many people who are deniers or on the fence about what I call a climate crisis.
Yeah.
And many people are more tepidly call it climate change. And I wanted to show, you know, the science behind these things rather than just making these sweeping statements, to show that there are learned researchers and scientists who have studied these issues for years and have peer-reviewed work that prove that, for instance, you know, the caribou herds are diminishing and et cetera. And again, in side notes, because the main narrative is you know, about the amazing Inuit people that I met and the wildlife and various suffering I did.
One of the other things that I really appreciated about it, that book, was that you, and I think your other writings as well, is that you give appropriate place names. You give the Inuit place names or the Inupiat place names, and oftentimes, or named appropriate names for animals, and oftentimes even sort of go into a little bit of like how that came to be or why that is the name, which I really appreciated and I found incredibly interesting.
Yeah, like the Inuit name for a particular cliff that looks like a penis. These place names are important, like Denali versus McKinley.
Yeah.
There's a reason why it should be called Denali, or it should be called the rock that looks like a penis.
Well, that's all I've got. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
That's all for today's show. Thank you to my guest, John Waterman. You can find more information about our guests and this show on the Outdoor Explorer page at alaskapublic.org. Thank you to our producer, Tobin Shelby, and to Ammon Swenson for his additional support. And from all the hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, thank you for listening, and we'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.